From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think the American people expect us to address the largest and most significant financial crisis since the Great Depression, caused by a collapse in our financial system, either because regulators didn't do their job or there were no cops on the beat at all.
Senator Christopher Dodd, chair of the Senate Banking Committee, which has just approved his measure to overhaul the nation's financial regulatory system. It now goes to the full Senate. It's been described as the biggest overhaul of financial rules since the 30s. But will it change anything? Then hundreds of students rally on Capitol Hill to support a massive overhaul of student loan programs.
This legislation, which USSA has fought for since its inception in 2001, would bring the United States one step closer to making education a fundamental right in this country by throwing open the college doors to undocumented students.
An international uproar over proposed anti-gay legislation in Uganda that would impose the death penalty for some homosexual acts. We'll be joined by a leading Ugandan gay rights organizer and a Zambian priest who's documented the role of American evangelicals in fostering homophobia in Uganda. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The congressional health care measure is being sent back to the House after Republicans successfully challenged it for violating reconciliation rules. The Senate parliamentarian has stricken what Democrats call two minor provisions, forcing the House to hold another vote. The Senate must first pass its version of the measure, with a vote expected later today. As Republicans challenge the bill in Congress, Democrats are voicing concern over security threats from angry constituents upset with the health care bill. At least 10 House Democrats have reported death threats or incidents of harassment at their district offices since last week. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said some lawmakers are concerned for their safety.
People start talking in the rhetoric of putting people on firing lines, that if they don't do something, they will have physical harm done to them, other rhetoric of that type, or they put a target on their faces with crosshairs. That activity ought to be unacceptable in our democracy.
Do you feel that your members are really at risk in terms of their security?
Yes. I think we've had very serious incidences that have occurred over the last 48, 72 hours.
Steny Hoyer says law enforcement agencies have offered increased protection to at least 10 lawmakers. President Obama, meanwhile, has quietly signed an executive order reaffirming a ban on federal funding for abortions under the new health care bill. Obama had pledged to issue the order to win votes from anti-abortion Democrats. Unlike the health care measure signing ceremony of the day before, Wednesday's signing of the executive order was held behind closed doors with no media allowed to watch. The U.S. and Russia have reached what's being described as their most extensive nuclear arms control pact in nearly two decades. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, would replace a 1991 agreement that expired last year. Details have not been released, but long-range nuclear weapons would be reduced from their current ceiling of 2,200 by at least 500. A formal announcement is expected in the coming days. The U.S. and Israeli governments appear to remain at an impasse after 2 days of talks and Israeli settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu extended a stay in Washington to return to the White House Wednesday. But Netanyahu has refused U.S. calls for a settlement freeze, and his government even announced a new East Jerusalem settlement expansion right before the latest talks. Despite objecting to the Israeli plans, the Obama administration has not threatened any punitive measures, including the withholding of billions of dollars in U.S. aid. At the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reaffirmed his stance that Israeli settlements are illegal.
I made it clear that all settlement activity is illegal, and that inserting settlers into Palestinian communities in Jerusalem is particularly troubling. This leads to tensions and undermines prospects for addressing the final status of Jerusalem. Yesterday's announcement that final approval has been given to build 20 settlement units in Sheikh Jarrah is unacceptable.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. is scaling back a number of harsh measures against Iran in a bid to win Russian and Chinese support for a new round of U.N. sanctions. The canceled proposals include restrictions that would have effectively closed international airspace and waters to Iranian cargo and curbs on insurance on Iranian companies and Iranian bonds. In Afghanistan, a large militant group has submitted a peace proposal to end fighting with the Afghan government and act as a bridge to the Taliban. The Islamic Party's overture calls for a U.S. withdrawal to begin next year. The group is headed by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a notorious warlord who received extensive U.S. backing during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. In Washington, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said talk of reconciliation with Afghan militants is premature.
My personal opinion is that in terms of reconciliation with the larger groups, it's probably early yet, or the more senior levels, that the shift of momentum is not yet strong enough to convince the Taliban leaders that they are, in fact, going to lose. And it's when they begin to have doubts about whether they can be successful that they may be willing to make a deal. And I don't think we're there yet.
The Obama administration's hosting a delegation of top Pakistani officials in Washington in a bid to increase military cooperation. Opening the talks Wednesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton praised U.S.-Pakistani ties.
Over the years, our relationship has been tested, but it has always endured. And I'm pleased we have come together again at this critical moment to reinforce our ties and recommit to building a partnership that will last. The United States comes to this dialogue with great respect for the nation and people of Pakistan. We recognize the central role that Pakistan plays in promoting security and prosperity.
The meetings come one day after a House Oversight and Government Reform subcommittee held a hearing on the legality of ongoing U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan. Last week, the ACLU filed a lawsuit demanding the U.S. government disclose the legal basis for the drone attacks and information on the civilian casualties they've caused. American University law professor Kenneth Anderson told lawmakers the Obama administration's secrecy on drone attacks could fuel legal action overseas.
The long-term effect of that, given that there are not necessarily statutes of limitations in these kinds of acts, could be the problem of CIA officers, or for that matter, military officers, or their lawyers being called up in front of international tribunals or courts of Spain or someplace and said, you've engaged in extrajudicial execution or simple murder, and we're going to investigate and indict.
In El Salvador, the Salvadoran Catholic Archbishop Oscar Onofre Romero was honored on Wednesday, on the 30th anniversary of his assassination. Known as the voice of the voiceless, Romero was a prominent advocate for the poor and a leading critic of the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military. He was killed while delivering mass at a hospital chapel by members of a U.S.-backed death squad. On Wednesday, Salvadoran President Mauricio Funes apologized for Romero's killing on behalf of the Salvadoran government.
I ask forgiveness from the thousands of families who were affected by this type of illegal and unacceptable violence, and especially to members of the religious communities represented by the spirit of Monsignor Romero, and who maintain alive his legacy of peace and respect for human rights. Again, as President of the Republic, I ask for forgiveness in the name of the Salvadoran state for this assassination that occurred 30 years ago and which took our best patriot from us.
Funes's statement marks the first time the Salvadoran government has taken responsibility for Archbishop Romero's murder. In Argentina, thousands of people rallied in Buenos Aires Wednesday to mark the anniversary of the 1976 coup that launched a seven-year military dictatorship. The dates marked every year as Truth and Justice Memorial Day, with calls to probe unsolved disappearances and prosecute former military officials. The Argentine president, Cristina Fernandez, told the crowd she'll pursue justice.
Allow me to make a commitment in front of you, in front of all of you, in front of all Argentines, that if we do not get justice in Argentina, as president, I will take it to other international courts to get justice.
A tiny island in the Bay of Bengal has disappeared underneath rising sea levels. The uninhabited island had been the source of dispute between India and Bangladesh for nearly three decades. Sugata Hasra, an oceanographer at the School of Oceanographic Studies in Calcutta, said, quote, what these two countries could not achieve from years of talking has been resolved by global warming. back in the United States, the Pentagon's expected to announce today new curbs on the enforcement of the ban on openly gay service members in the U.S. military. Under the new rules, the military will no longer probe the sexual orientation of service members based on anonymous complaints, will restrict third-party testimony, and order a high-level review of all cases. Administration officials describe the measures as temporary until Congress fully repeals Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The New York Times is reporting top Vatican officials, including Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, yes, the current Pope Benedict XVI, failed to defrock a Wisconsin-based priest who molested as many as 200 deaf boys. The priest, Lawrence C. Murphy, worked at a school for the deaf children from 1950 to 1974. Internal documents show Vatican officials, including Ratzinger, knew of the allegations but were most concerned with protecting the church's image. The news comes as the Vatican says it's accepted the resignation of a bishop accused of mishandling abuse allegations in Ireland. And in Indonesia, a leading television news network is reporting the Indonesian military is planning to charge journalist Alan Nairn with, quote, smearing its good name. In an appearance on Democracy Now! Last week, Alan Nairn exposed that U.S.-backed Indonesian armed forces assassinated a series of civilian activists in the province of Aceh last year. Democracy Now! Reached Alan earlier today, just before going to air.
TV1, the Indonesian news channel, is running a text headline at the bottom of the screen saying that TNI, the Indonesian armed forces, are planning to charge me, to have me arrested. They then ran a second text headline at the bottom of the screen saying that they have filed such charges for tarnishing the name of TNI, the name of the armed forces. So it's slightly ambiguous whether they are merely planning to have me arrested or whether they have already filed the papers with the police to do so.
And what does smearing the name of the military mean? What is the penalty for that?
Well, there's a whole series of statutes, but the lawyers I've spoken to say it could involve up to 6 years in prison.
Alan Nairn broke the story just as the White House is engaged in fierce behind-the-scenes negotiations with Congress on restoring Indonesian military aid. Nairn has issued a public challenge welcoming his arrest so that he can face off with the military in open court to expose the facts, he says. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. With the main health care reform bill signed into law, Democrats say congressional efforts to reform Wall Street and the nation's financial regulatory system will soon top the Obama administration's agenda. On Wednesday, the president held a strategy meeting at the White House with Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd and House Financial Services Committee Chair Barney Frank. The meeting came 2 days after the Senate Banking Committee advanced Dodd's measure to overhaul financial regulation on a party-line vote. Dodd spoke to reporters after Wednesday's meeting.
We intend to get a strong financial reform package. We're going to end too big to fail. And never again are American taxpayers going to be asked to bail out a failing financial institution because they have an implicit guarantee from the federal government. We're going to have a strong consumer protection agency so that people can count on someone watching out for their interests on mortgages and credit cards and other financial activities. We want to have that systemic risk council so we have a good radar system to pick up problems before they challenge and threaten the entire financial system. In our country, we want strong statements and strong regulations on dealing with exotic instruments like over-the-counter derivatives and others that can put our system at risk. I think the American people expect us to address the largest and most significant financial crisis since the Great Depression, caused by a collapse in our financial system, either because regulators didn't do their job or there were no cops on the beat at all, and certainly in unregulated activities that contributed to this mess.
Meanwhile, Congressman Barney Frank said the issue of financial regulatory reform will be Congress's number one concern after a two-week Easter break. The Dodd bill has been described as the biggest overhaul of financial rules since the 1930s. The measure includes new regulations of derivatives, new protections and incentives for Wall Street whistleblowers, and the establishment of an oversight body for credit rating agencies. But critics have faulted Dodd's proposal for giving additional power to the Federal Reserve while gutting the proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency and housing it inside the Fed. Economists are also divided over whether the bill does enough to address the too-big-to-fail banking problem.
To talk more about reforming Wall Street, we're joined by two guests. Rob Johnson is a former economist at the Senate Banking Committee and the Senate Budget Committee. He's now the director of the Economic Policy Initiative at the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. Kai Wright is the editorial director at Color Lines Magazine and a fellow at the Nation Institute. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Kai Wright, let's begin with you. This whole issue of this consumer agency that was, or the one that's being now put into the Fed, explain it. What's happened to it?
Well, the idea was to create somebody in Washington who is explicitly tasked with looking out for consumers. There's the authority already exists, but the whole host of regulators that are there, their concern has been with the health of the banking sector, not with their customers. And so the idea was to create an agency that had broad authority and that was independent. That was where we started probably about a year ago. What we have in Senator Dodd's bill is it is an agency that—or it's a bureau that has broad authority, so it can police the large banks and it can police the non-bank players, payday lenders and the mortgage brokers that peddled these subprime loans. But it's not independent. It is inside the Fed, and it has an oversight board that is made up of the very regulators who failed to act for the last decade, can overrule its decisions. And so there's a question about—
Why does this matter to you?
Well, because the bottom line is that the consumers were the kindling for this fire in the first instance. If somebody had been able to stop the predatory products that they were peddling in neighborhoods all over the country, particularly these subprime loans, then—and frankly, before the subprime loans, all the things that drove up credit and debt to lead consumers to be vulnerable for these subprime loans, then we would have never gotten this far down the road. And there were people who saw it at the time, but they didn't have the power to act. And so we need to create somebody who has the power to act.
Well, what does the legislation do in terms of actual real teeth in regulation of these kinds of loans?
Well, so the bureau that will be inside the Fed will have the ability to write and enforce new rules. So they can see a new product coming and say, hey, that's a predatory product. You can't do that, or you have to do it this way. The problem is that the oversight board, which will be made up of, you know, Secretary Geithner and the head chair of the Fed and all of the existing bank regulators, has the ability to say, no, you can't do that. And so, to the degree that you have a really strong head of this bureau, that person will stand up and fight. But the minute you don't have a strong head, then you've got just another bureau that has no power.
Rob Johnson, you were the chief economist on the Senate Banking Committee. The significance of the shift from being independent to being inside the Fed and what this overall means?
Well, it's enormously significant. It's designed to neuter the Consumer Financial Protection Initiative. You put it inside the Fed, and the Fed's primary responsibility is safety and soundness of large financial institutions, protecting the system from the kind of failure we just had. They need to collect information from those large banks. If those large banks are angry with them, they'll have a fight on their primary mission, and it's certain that the consumer financial protection frontier will anger those banks. So the missions are incompatible. It should not be inside the Fed. And furthermore, the Fed should not be rewarded for the kind of failure it did in supervision, examination, and its role in the unfolding crisis.
And in terms of the overall bill, especially on the situation of dealing with the banks that caused this crisis, Senator Dick Durbin, in a radio interview a few days ago, said that it's hard to believe in a time when we're facing a banking crisis that many of the banks created, that the banks are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill. They frankly own the place.
Yes. As we approach the election, elected officials know the American people are enraged, particularly about the question of too big to fail, large institutions that aren't subject to the same rules as everyone else. At the same time, they need money for their reelection in this money-gushed politics system that we have. So we're engaged in a kabuki theater right now, hoping the material is too complex for the American people to understand, declaring victory and yet basically encoding into law current practices of the banks. Every one of your listeners should ask the question, given this legislation, if the President, House, and Senate pass it, will we be in a place where AIG couldn't have happened, Lehman Brothers couldn't have happened, Bear Stearns couldn't have happened, and more importantly, 9-10% unemployment caused by the banking crisis couldn't have happened? I argue this bill does very little, and even Gary Gensler, who's probably the strongest element of the administration at the CFTC, argued yesterday at the Chamber of Commerce that it does not do the job. The end user loopholes in derivatives regulation, which is, to my mind, the San Andreas fault of the financial system.
We're going to continue this conversation after break. We're talking to Rob Johnson. He is the former chief economist at the Senate Banking Committee, now director of the Economic Policy Initiative at the Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, and Kai Wright, editorial director of Color Lines magazine and a fellow at the Nation Institute. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Lives are shaped by what we love, by Odyssey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, Kai Wright, editorial director of Color Lines magazine, fellow at the Nation Institute, and Rob Johnson, director of the Economic Policy Initiative at the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. Juan?
Rob, I wanted to follow up on what we were talking about before the break. You were mentioning the regulation of derivatives and as the San Andreas fault of this legislation. Could you expound on that? What is the bill proposing to do? And what really should be done in terms of this time bomb, this continuing time bomb of derivatives in our economy?
The derivatives are traded what's called over-the-counter, which means embedded on the balance sheets of the large too-big-to-fail banks. Too-big-to-fail is intimately connected, therefore, to derivatives. Derivatives that are complex, opaque, difficult to price, put the system at risk, but they make enormous profits for the five largest banks. Five largest banks control about 97% of the derivatives market. You get to a place where they allow these complex things to continue. The next time the system is shocked, everybody will scurry around not knowing what they're worth, not knowing what the other banks are worth, and the credit market can continue to freeze up. They need to make very substantial changes where all derivatives are put on exchanges and cleared, prices marked twice a day, and customers can see what does a derivative contract trade for. They're going to look up on an electronic screen just like they do for foreign exchange or interest rates. The opaqueness is directly connected to the profitability of the banks, and it's directly connected to the risk of the system.
And most people don't realize how big the derivatives market is compared to the regular banking system. Could you give our viewers and listeners a sense of the proportionality we're talking about?
The notional value of derivatives by the top 25 banks is about $300 trillion. American GDP is $15 trillion. So I think that's roughly 20 times the size of the American economy. It is the biggest dimension of the balance sheets of all the major banks.
And it's largely unregulated.
And if they were going to tolerate these so-called end-user exemptions, they should pay a huge capital surcharge for the right to put the system at risk, and that's not what's happening.
Rob Johnson, I almost missed your testimony in October because I blanked, but you were the only non-industry expert who was invited to testify before the House Financial Services Committee on the derivatives market.
Right.
Talk about what happened in October.
What happened in October is that with about 14 hours to go, Americans for Financial Reform and other consumer groups and labor unions became upset. they didn't have anybody being represented with a point of view. Michael Greenberger, who's a greater expert than I am on this, was considered someone they wouldn't accept. I have worked both for the Republican and Democratic Party earlier in my career, so both parties would accept me. I came in, testified. Melissa Bean was in the chair, a congressperson from Illinois who's very friendly with the banks, and she gaveled down my opening statement. I asked if I could submit the rest for the record, and prior to the testimony, I said, I'd like to be able to put this in the record because you're asking me to testify on a 142-page bill with about 14 hours' notice.
How much time did you speak?
14 hours. I spoke for about 4 minutes before I got cut off, after listening for an hour and a half to eight different industry group representatives. Subsequently, there was a rough and tumble, and eventually Barney Frank was cornered by the Christian Science Monitor and I believe Harper's Magazine in a press conference, and he said, mea culpa. He called me. I met with him, and he apologized, and he put things on the website and in the record.
So your entire testimony that you didn't get to give was put into the record?
Yes. It's available on their website from October 7th of 2009. It's there now.
It's easier to understand now this issue of people not really understanding what's going on. Kai Wright, the significance of this and what is able to be gotten away with and who really gets hurt. In the long run.
I mean, I think we can't underestimate the problem of it being so complicated on its—it sounds complicated, right, when we start talking about it. But it's actually really quite simple. When I started reporting on the subprime crisis, what struck me probably the most was how unsurprised anybody who had been working in communities where all of this predatory lending had been taking place for 15 years.
What are those communities?
They're largely Black and Latino communities, but they're working class communities all over the country. Places where we had run up, where credit card companies and payday lenders and the whole swarm, I would call it, of financial players had run up a bunch of debt and put people with their backs against the wall and made them, left them vulnerable to these come-ons from mortgage brokers. Keep in mind, again, that's, you know, something like 60% of subprime borrowers were steered into these loans. So the people who were working in these communities were not at all surprised when the world looked up and said, oh my God, we could have never seen this coming. They said, yeah, we could. We said it was coming. We told you it was coming. Here's the testimony that we gave to our state legislatures, the community advisory board of the Fed. Here's the testimony we gave to the Fed saying that this was going to be a problem. The problem is nobody acted. And nobody acted because it wasn't in anyone's interest to protect consumers. All of the existing regulators, their interest is in protecting the health of the banking sector. That doesn't mean they're bad people. Well, they may or may not be bad people. But their job is not protecting consumers. And so the goal here is to create something that actually protects consumers. And if that thing has to answer to the regulators who ignored all the people who were talking about this is a problem for consumers 10 years ago, then it's not going to do it. And that's simple. That's straightforward. People knew this was going to happen. They said it was going to happen. The people responsible for stopping it didn't do it. And now we're putting those same people in charge of stopping it again.
And Rob Johnson, in terms of warnings, the last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of the influential publications in the nation have been resurrecting the discussion about the dangers faced by the Social Security system. A front page article in today's New York Times saying for the first time this year, it appears that Social Security will pay out more to recipients than it will be taking in. And they're claiming that the economic crisis, the number of people that are unemployed, are exacerbating the situation because there are not as many people paying into the system. Your sense, it appears that the Obama administration has been sending signals for quite a while that it intends to tackle the, quote, Social Security crisis. And I'm wondering your thoughts on that, the crisis and its relationship to the general economic crisis the country's facing.
Well, Juan, you're right that a drumbeat is building. A bipartisan deficit reduction committee is building. I experience a great deal of outrage. For us to look at the debt growth from this banking crisis, what economists call the debt-to-GDP ratio, it's gone from about 40%, they predict it'll go to 85%, more than doubling. The deficit hawks, when we were doing bank bailouts, took a vacation underwater. They're now talking as though grandma in 2049 is risking our financial health. I don't see any of those same people on deck as deficit hawks saying, we need financial reform of a really profound form because we can't afford to go from 85 to 125% of GDP with our debt. And this stuff really does matter. It matters to roads, bridges, schools, senior aid, and health care. Just like the health care bill, which pads the profits for all of industry, then we'll complain that Medicare costs are out of control. It's not because grandma is consuming too much medicine. It's that we don't have a competitive system in health care provision, health care insurance, or in pharmaceuticals. This is a problem of governance. It is a problem mathematically. But the problem isn't with Social Security.
And yet, as we were talking before the show, Juan, we are seeing a drumbeat of newspaper articles now on television. You see all the pundits saying, have you seen Social Security? It looks like more is being paid out than we're taking in. The drumbeat is developing.
Right. And my question, obviously, as we've discussed this before, the idea that a particular a part of government services is costing more. Mm-hmm. It's never, for instance, raised about the Defense Department. That the Defense Department is costing too much, and we need to cut back on defense spending.
Or that my alma mater, the hedge fund industry, pays 15% income taxes under what they call carry interest provisions rather than true income taxes. Warren Buffett even jokes about this. He says his income tax rate is lower than his secretary's.
If Bush's privatization of Social Security had gone through, would it have been wiped out in the financial crisis?
Well, it would have taken the same magnitude of losses that, say, the equity market did, so a substantial amount of losses, yes.
Lehman Brothers head Brian Marsal was just in Berlin at a bankruptcy conference, and in an interview with a British, with a German business daily, he said that the Wall Street, that the banks are in for another mega bank bankruptcy. Is this true?
I don't think it's imminent, but I do think it's true. And where I think it's where it's hidden right now. Is that you have a whole bunch of second mortgages and equity lines of credit that are embedded in the big banks that are being priced at about 85 cents on the dollar. They're probably worthless. But no one in the accounting profession or at the Treasury or the Fed is forcing these people to realize those losses. Now, what does that mean? If you overstate the value of your assets and you don't take your losses, then you can overstate your earnings and then you can pay big bonuses. So,
and Kai, finally, I'd like to ask you, what can the consumers who will be affected by this consumer, this new consumer protection agency, do now as this bill is moves through the Senate?
Well, it's the same thing that all of us are going to have to do, which is continue to hold elected officials accountable. It's tough. We saw it for health care. We're seeing it now in financial reform. We'll probably see it when they get to immigration reform. It is difficult these days to get get voters' voices heard by their elected officials. And I think we have to do the same things we always have to do. We have to let them know we're out there. We have to let them know we're paying attention, and try to stop it. It's barreling ahead, and it's clear that they don't want to accept a whole lot of amendments. They want to get this thing passed fast.
And the banks are very happy. Is that right? I mean,
my colleague Mike Consul at the Roosevelt Institute put on the blog at New Deal 2.0 the other day, what would Goldman Sachs dislike about this? And the answer was nothing, really. And he did some research. He called people behind the scenes. They're not opposing this bill because there's nothing in it that takes a bite out of them.
Rob Johnson, we want to thank you for being with us. Rob Johnson's Director of Economic Policy Initiative at the new Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, and Kai Wright, Editorial Director of Color Lines Magazine and a Fellow at the Nation Institute. Thank you both for being with us as we continue on this issue of finances, especially when it comes to young people and student loans. Juan?
Well, banks and other private lenders may be on the verge of losing a profitable $70 billion a year business in student loans. The Senate is gearing up to vote this week on a massive overhaul of college assistance programs. The measure would end the role of private banks in federally backed student loans and make the government the primary lender. Tens of billions of dollars in savings from the measure would be diverted into education grants. The House approved the overhaul as part of the health care package, now before the Senate. If it passes, the bill would mean the loss of billions of dollars in business to student lending giant Sallie Mae, as well as large financial institutions such as Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America. Private lenders have launched an intensified lobbying effort to defeat the measure and send it back to the House.
Well, on Tuesday, hundreds of students from around the country came to Washington, D.C. to rally on Capitol Hill in support of the bill. Gregory Sandana is the president of the United States Student Association. He helped organize the rally. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Explain exactly what this bill is and what it would mean for students and, well, post-students, people who are paying back their loans.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. As you mentioned, this bill is historic, and it's going to infuse billions of dollars into important education programs. The biggest part of it for us is that it's going to eliminate the middle person. It's going to eliminate the subsidies to Sallie Mae, to Citibank, and these other banks and lenders, and actually put that money into important higher education programs like the Pell Grant and supporting minority-serving institutions like historically Black colleges and universities and community colleges as well.
And Gregory, the impact of this legislation in terms of, for instance, I understand that Pell Grants, which used to represent about 72% of what students were paying in terms of tuition, is now down to about 32% as tuition has continued to increase and the grants have not.
Yeah, that's correct. And we're really hoping for the Senate to pass this, because if the Senate doesn't pass this and this doesn't go into law, there's going to be almost 500,000 students that might actually not qualify for the Pell Grant anymore. And there's going to be different Pell Grant recipients that might see their packages be cut up to 60% if this funding isn't included with the Pell Grant.
Gregory Sandana, how are private lenders lobbying against this bill?
Private lenders and banks are spending millions of dollars on lobbyists, are infusing the airwaves with lies about what this bill would do. And one of the things I actually will just bring up right now is that they're talking about the potential job loss that this might have. And the reality is, and the truth of the matter is that the direct loans program actually has to have all the jobs here in the U.S. And one thing that Sallie Mae isn't talking about when they're lobbying or when they're sharing this message on the airwaves is that they actually had to bring back more than 2,000 jobs that they had internationally back to the U.S. in order to actually get a contract with one of the direct loans programs with the Department of Education. And so we're very aware of the impact to the higher education programs and the ability for this job to also move our economy back on track, keep jobs and have jobs here in the U.S. and be able to fund students and families who need this support so much.
And Gregory, could you talk about what the impact has been on students the past few decades now of these huge loans that they end up saddled with as they get out of college, and especially the role of some of the universities in cooking up deals with the banks that provide these loans?
Yeah, each year the average graduate graduates with about $25,000 in debt, and that's a lot of debt. I mean, even for myself, I'm a recent graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles. I received the maximum Pell Grant. I received a Cal Grant. I had work study, but still ended up with more than $40,000 in loans. And my story isn't singular. Millions of students across the country are having to graduate with massive amounts of debt. We call it, like, at USSA, we say it's like mortgage-sized loan debt, where they either have to derail their plans for post-graduate studies or have to take on jobs that actually pay more, even though that's not what they want to do, to be able to actually afford to be able to pay it back. And what we're hoping is that we're going to see the increased funding for federal grant programs like the Pell Grant, and that students will be able to actually live the lives they want to live and not be burdened by these huge amounts of debt.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson has been a leading voice in the campaign to reform student loans. Last year, he launched this campaign called Reduce the Rate, urging the Obama administration to slash the interest rates on student loans. Well, Reverend Jackson spoke this past weekend at the Left Forum here in New York. This is some of what he had to say about student loans.
If you come out here with a guaranteed debt, then a guaranteed job, even while you don't have the job, the tab is still running. It's compounded interest. Now, if we can, if the banks can get 0% interest, students should be able to get 0% interest. If we can get 0% interest for the clunker and for the car, the government is charging, they're going to move us now, which is a step in the right direction from Sally Mae type lending, oppressive lending scheme to the government. And while you got a relative to friend the government, that's all right, but we need not a new lender, we need a new rate. The rate should be 0 as opposed to 6-7%. They make enough money off of student loan defaults to fund the Pell Grants.
That's the Reverend Jesse Jackson at Left Forum in New York this past weekend. Gregory Sandana, president of the United States Student Association, where exactly does this legislation stand, and how did it get tied into the health reform legislation?
Yeah, so right now, the current legislation is being debated in the Senate. After it's being debated in the Senate, depending on the types of amendments, it's going to have to actually go back to the House for a vote. But we're hoping that all this process is going to be finished up here in the next couple of days, actually, within the week. And it got to be a part of the reconciliation package because we knew from the beginning that it was going to have to—it would have to go through this. And essentially, because of the savings that it has, and the ability to decrease the deficit, we would be able to use a reconciliation process because of the amount of savings it had.
And could you talk about the DREAM Act that the Obama administration has been supportive of up until this time? What is the DREAM Act, and what would it mean in terms of immigrant children who are students at universities in this country?
Yes. So each year, more than 65,000 undocumented students graduate from high school that would qualify for the DREAM Act. And essentially, the DREAM Act would actually provide a pathway to legalization, as well as qualify them for federal financial aid, specifically with loans and work study. Far too long, these students, undocumented students, are work hard. They're the valedictorians of they're athletes. They're people who excel in school and have been barred access to higher education simply because this legislation hasn't passed. USSA has been a staunch advocate and supporter of the DREAM Act since its inception in 2001, and are now seeing that. The momentum has been building. Youth, immigrant youth, undocumented students, and allies all across the country are saying the DREAM Act must pass, and it must pass now.
But what do you say to those people who say that these students are in the country illegally and they should not receive such benefits?
Well, the reality is a lot of these students actually didn't have the choice to come here. Their parents brought them here when they were very young, so they grew up here and know the United States as their home. We also talk about how we already invest lots of money through K-12, and by not investing in their higher education, we're wasting the money that we've invested for that long. And right now, in this economy, what we really need is to continue to infuse money into higher education, because these students, all they want to do is actually give back to their families, give back to their communities, work hard, and have a job, and they can't do that simply because this legislation hasn't passed yet.
And the DREAM Act stands for the Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors Act, which would grant permanent citizenship to undocumented workers' children if they complete 2 years of college, trade school, or military service. And we're going to be following this march that's going from Florida, 15 miles a day, to Washington, D.C., by students in support of the act. It's called the Trail of Dreams. And some of those who are marching in this march to Washington are undocumented students. Gregory Sandana, we want to thank you very much for being with us, president of the United States Student Association, a recent graduate of UCLA with a mighty hefty debt himself, $40,000 to pay. Good luck, Gregory. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Africa to see my life. And I won't leave the battle.
get it to be kid Africa yan pamba, Africa yan twala, and tambuli na mwoyo. Zoko kate weba kate gama towuli rizi. Obwafu, entaro, entwate, corruption, abali benguzi, bebasiko wunji kati. Tutu sa foga na fasi, 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 fasi.
Uganda by DJ Spooky. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, on college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 250 are. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
We turn now to the East African nation of Uganda and the international uproar over a proposed anti-gay legislation. Homosexuality is already illegal in Uganda, but the new bill would impose much harsher punishments, including life imprisonment and even the death penalty for some homosexual acts. It would also require people to report every LGBT individual they know or face imprisonment. The proposed bill has been condemned by activists and politicians around the world, and earlier this month, campaigners gave the Ugandan parliament an online petition against the bill, signed by some 450,000 people. Speaking at the Fellowship Foundation's National Prayer Breakfast last month, both President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke out against the bill.
I recently called President Museveni, whom I have known through the prayer breakfast, and expressed the strongest concerns about a law being considered in the Parliament of Uganda.
We may disagree about gay marriage, but surely we can agree that it is unconscionable to target gays and lesbians for who they are, whether it's here in the United States or, as Hillary mentioned, more extremely in odious laws that are being proposed most recently in Uganda.
Well, the author of the bill President Obama called odious is Ugandan lawmaker David Bahati, who organizes the Ugandan National Prayer Breakfast and has well-documented ties to the far-right evangelical movement here in the United States. Last year, Political Research Associates published an exposé on the complicity of conservative American religious forces in encouraging homophobia in Uganda. The report's called Globalizing the Culture Wars, U.S. Conservatives, African Churches, and Homophobia. We're joined now in Boston by the author of the report, Reverend Kapia Keoma. He's an Anglican priest from Zambia. Last year, he attended an anti-gay conference held in the Ugandan capital of Kampala and documented the role of American evangelicals in fostering homophobia. Also joining us from Boston, Frank Mugisha. He's the spokesperson for Uganda's leading LGBT rights organization, Sexual Minorities Uganda. He's here in the U.S. on a speaking tour. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let us begin with Frank Mugisha. Tell us what's happening now in Uganda. What is the state of this bill, and what exactly it would mean?
Thank you so much. Right now, the Ugandan community is very tense, the LGBT community. There's a lot of hostility targeting the grassroots people. There's a lot of homophobia that has been increased because of ongoing demonstrations around the country. These demonstrations are done by religious groups. At this moment, legislators have not gone back to parliament to discuss this bill for another time because of the international criticism it has received. There has been a lot of pressure from human rights groups all over the world, different leaders all over the world who have condemned this anti-homosexuality bill and have asked the Ugandan government to totally withdraw it. We've worked with activists all over the world and within the country in Uganda. My organization, Sexual Minorities Uganda, has been pushing so much members of parliament in my country and also asking the communities in Uganda to try and stop this legislation. But again, because of religious groups going around the country, demonstrating and calling upon the Ugandan nation to try and ask parliament to push this law very fast and pass it, the homophobia has greatly increased in Uganda. A lot of LGBT people are suffering. We've got to get people out of prison almost every day. We've got to help people who are being thrown out of homes because of this homophobia that has been increased because of the religious groups that have gone around the country calling for this law to be enacted immediately. Thank you.
Reverend Kapya Kaoma, you have been documenting the role of U.S. Right-wing groups and evangelical groups over in Uganda. Could you talk about what you found, the conferences that have been held there, and especially about Mr. Robert Lively and the Pink Swastika, the book that he's written?
Thank you very much. The research was sanctioned by Political Research Associates. And we are trying to understand the relationship between American conservatives and African religious leaders and their impact on American gay and lesbian kind of politics in mainline churches. But the research, when we went to Africa, we realized that the same key players in American politics are having a role in African anti-gay politics. And I was in Uganda at the time when Scott Lively of Abiding Truth Ministries was holding this conference, which was termed a seminar exposing the anti-homosexual agenda. And what it did is that it told Ugandans that there is this international gay movement to take over the world. It has managed to take over the United States government. It has taken over the UN. It has taken over the country of Brazil. And now, in Brazil, for instance, people who are opposed to gays and lesbians, they are being forced out of their country. And if Uganda does not stop them, then they will do the same thing because they are now their new target is Uganda. So Lively preached a lot of hatred against LGBT persons.
Can you talk about the forces, Reverend Kapya Kaoma, in the United States that are supporting the anti-gay forces in Africa, in Uganda?
Currently, the forces that are supporting the bill in Uganda have all distanced themselves. For instance, we have Scott Lively saying the bill goes too far. Pastor Rick Warren of Sadaback in California has also said no, he denounces the bill. The American conservative churches, which are broken away from the Episcopal Church, are saying they are no longer part of the bill. There's no American conservative who is prepared to say that they are for this bill. But before this bill was proposed, they were the ones who were, in fact, in forefront, preaching and using homophobia as an organizing tool. Pastor Warren was in Africa doing his so-called purpose-driven projects. He has purpose-driven projects in Nigeria. He has a purpose-driven project in Rwanda. He has the same project in Uganda. And ironically, all these countries I've mentioned, they have new laws against homosexuality. His friends are Archbishop Akinola of Nigeria. We have Orombi, Henry Orombi of Uganda. These are the very people who are advocating for anti-gay laws in their countries. So you can see that they distance themselves now because the fire is burning. But they are friends in Africa, the same people who are for this bill.
And Reverend,
and the other thing I have to point out is this, that
go ahead.
We have a group of Americans, like the Institute on Religion and Democracy, headed by Mark Turi, currently, who is their president. This is a group which has used homophobia as an organizing tool in Africa. It has misrepresented or taken the American politics of gays and lesbians in this country and used it as a reason for them to get African on their side. And unfortunately, when the fire now is burning against LGBTI persons in Africa, these groups are silent about this bill. So we need to hold these groups accountable.
And Reverend Keomo, you attended the now infamous anti-gay conference in Kampala last year. I'd like to play a tape of a clip from one of the Americans who spoke at that conference. This is Scott Lively, who we've been mentioning, a prominent anti-gay conservative Christian activist.
The gay movement is an evil institution. The goal of the gay movement is to defeat the marriage-based society and replace it with a culture of sexual promiscuity in which there's no restrictions on sexual conduct except the principle of mutual choice.
That was Scott Lively. In the report that you have done, Reverend Kapiakeoma, you say in the United States, the renewal groups are the problem. In the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church USA, the Presbyterian Church USA, U.S. conservative evangelicals, and the Institute on Religion and Democracy, the neoconservative think tank that for decades has sought to undermine Protestant denominations' tradition of progressive social justice work. Are you having members of these churches supporting your work? And I wanted to ask Frank Mugisha that question as well, from these very churches that are opposing those within these churches that are working towards this anti-gay legislation.
I must say that we had an advisory board from some of these churches, like the Episcopal Church, the Methodist Church, and the Presbyterian Church. And the role they played is just to allow us understand the politics of the anti-gay politics in their churches. As to work with them directly on this bill, we know that their churches have sent statements opposing the bill in Uganda. The presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in America has sent a statement condemning the bill. The same thing has happened from other groups, but we don't necessarily work with them directly. What we are trying to do is to let them know that these groups of the renewal movements are doing a lot of harm outside the world using the gay politics, and what they should do is to come up with a strategy of countering this, because if they don't counter it, then the people in Africa are going to suffer the consequences.
Frank Mugisha, your response, and can you talk about where you're traveling in the United States as you are a spokesperson for sexual minorities group called Sexual Minorities Uganda?
Thank you so much. My take on the support is that, of course, there are some religious groups that have come out and condemned this bill, but I'll give you a small background of my activism in Uganda. My activism comes in because I'm a gay person in Uganda. Because of the hostility we've gone through, because of the homophobia we've faced in Uganda, we find ourselves doing this kind of work. But we don't have the research, we don't have the kind of support that the people like who fight homosexuality in Uganda have. People like Pastor Martin Sempa, they have PhDs, they have they have strong supporters who even come down and support them from the grassroots. But in Uganda, for us, the research, like the political research Eshet did, this was a tool that was one of its kind that we've started using at this moment. And we would like such kind of support to continue happening for us. And then talking about the religious groups that support us in Uganda, people who are progressive and liberal to homosexuality in my country, if they come out and support us, then they are going to be labeled homosexuals themselves, which becomes kind of dangerous for them and their families, because Uganda is very homophobic. So they come out and support, and then they tend to shy away again. We've got people who have supported us and have been labeled homosexuals. So this kind of environment gives us very little support. That's why
Frank Mugisha, we're
going
to have to leave it there, and I thank you for being with us. The show is ending. Frank Mugisha, spokesperson for Sexual Minorities Uganda, and Reverend Kapiakeoma with the Political Research Associates. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org.